we know is merely an inference from that. And yet, we've seen that when we say with moderate precision what we mean by words such as happiness, we still can't be sure that two people who claim to be happy are having the same experience, or that our current experience of happiness is really different from our past experience of happiness, or that we're having an experience of happiness at all. If the goal of science is to make us feel awkward and ignorant in the presence of things we once understood perfectly well, then psychology has succeeded above all others. But like happiness, science is one of those words that means too many things to too many people and is thus often at risk of meaning nothing at all. My father is an eminent biologist who, after pondering the matter for some decades, recently revealed to me that psychology can't really be a science because science requires the use of electricity. Apparently, shocks to your ankles don't count. My own definition of science is a bit more eclectic, but one thing about which I, my dad, and most other scientists can agree is that if a thing can't be measured, then it can't be studied scientifically. It can be studied, and one might even argue that the study of such unquantifiables is more worthwhile than all the sciences laid end to end. But it's not science, because science is about measurement. And if a thing can't be measured, can't be compared with a clock or a ruler, or something other than itself, it's not a potential object of scientific inquiry. As we've seen, it's extremely difficult to measure an individual's happiness and feel completely confident in the validity and reliability of that measurement. People may not know how they feel or remember how they felt, and even if they do, scientists can never know exactly how their experience maps onto their description of that experience, and hence, they cannot know precisely how to interpret people's claims. All of this suggests that the scientific study of subjective experience is bound to be tough going. Tough, yes, but not impossible, because the chasm between experiences can be bridged, not with steel girders or a six-lane toll road, mind you, but with a length of reasonably sturdy rope, if we accept three premises. Measuring right. The first premise is something that any carpenter could tell you. Imperfect tools are a real pain, but they sure beat pounding nails with your teeth. The nature of subjective experience suggests there will never be a happiometer, a perfectly reliable instrument that allows an observer to measure with complete accuracy the characteristics of another person's subjective experience so that the measurement can be taken, recorded, and compared with another. If we demand that level of perfection from our tools, then we better pack up the eye trackers, brain scanners, and color swatches and cede the study of subjective experience to the poets, who did a nice job with it for the first few thousand years. But if we do that, then it's only fair that we hand them the study of almost everything else as well. Chronometers, thermometers, barometers, spectrometers, and every other device that scientists use to measure the objects of their interest are imperfect. Every one of them introduces some degree of error into the observations it allows, which is why governments and universities pay obscene sums of money each year for the slightly more perfect version of each. And if we're purging ourselves of all things that afford us only imperfect approximations of the truth, then we need to discard not only psychology and the physical sciences, but law, economics, and history as well. In short, if we adhere to the standard of perfection in all our endeavors, we're left with nothing but mathematics and the White Album. So maybe we just need to accept a bit of fuzziness and stop complaining. The second premise is that of all the flawed measures of subjective experience that we can take, the honest, real-time report of the attentive individual is the least flawed. There are many other ways to measure happiness, of course, and some of them appear to be much more rigorous, scientific, and objective than a person's own claims. For example, electromyography allows us to measure the electrical signals produced by the striated muscles of the face, such as the corrugator supercilia, which furrows our brows when we experience something unpleasant, or the zygomaticus major, which pulls our mouths up towards our ears when we smile. Physiography allows us to measure the electrodermal, respiratory, and cardiac activity of the autonomic nervous system, all of which change when we experience strong emotions. Electroencephalography, positron emission tomography, and magnetic resonance imaging allow us to measure electrical activity and blood flow in different regions of the brain, such as the left and right prefrontal cortex, which tend to be active when we're experiencing positive and negative emotions, respectively. Even a clock can be a useful device for measuring happiness because startled people tend to blink more slowly when they're feeling happy than when they're feeling fearful or anxious. Scientists who rely on the honest real-time reports of attentive individuals often feel the need to defend that choice by reminding us that these reports correlate strongly with other measures of happiness. But in a sense, they've got it backward. After all, the only reason why we take any of these bodily events, from muscle movement to cerebral blood flow, as indices of happiness as that people tell us they are. If everyone claimed to feel raging anger or a thick black depression when their zygomatic muscle contracted, their eye blink slowed, and the left anterior brain region filled with blood, then we'd have to revise our interpretation of these physiological changes and take them as indices of unhappiness instead. If we want to know how a person feels, we must begin by acknowledging the fact that there is one, and only one, observer stationed at the critical point of view. She may not always remember what she felt before, and she may not always be aware of what she's feeling right now. We may be puzzled by her reports, skeptical of her memory, and worried about her ability to use language as we do. But when all our hand-wringing is over, we must admit that she is the only person who has even the slightest chance of describing the view from in here, which is why her claims serve as the gold standard against which all other measures are measured. We'll have greater confidence in her claims when they jibe with what other less privileged observers tell us, when we feel confident that she evaluates her experience against the same background that we do, when her body does what most other bodies do when they experience what she's claiming to experience, and so on. But even when all of these various indices of happiness dovetail nicely, we can't be perfectly sure that we know the truth about her inner world. We can, however, be sure that we've come as close as observers ever get, and that has to be good enough. Measuring often. The third premise is that imperfections in measurement are always a problem, but they are a devastating problem only when we don't recognize them. If we have a deep scratch in our eyeglasses and don't know it, we may erroneously conclude that a small crack has opened in the fabric of space and is following us wherever we go. But if we're cognizant of the scratch, we can do our best to factor it out of our observations, reminding ourselves that what looks like a rip in space is really just a flaw in the device we're using to observe it. What can scientists do to see through the flaws inherent in reports of subjective experiences? The answer lies in a phenomenon that statisticians call the law of large numbers. Many of us have a mistaken idea about large numbers, namely that they're like small numbers, only bigger. As such, we expect them to do more of what small numbers do, but not to do anything different. So, for instance, we know that two neurons swapping electrochemical signals across their axons and dendrites can't possibly be conscious. Nerve cells are simple devices, less complex than walkie-talkies from Sears, and they do one simple thing, namely react to the chemicals that reach them by releasing chemicals of their own. If we blithely go on to assume that 10 billion of these simple devices can only do 10 billion simple things, we would never guess that billions of them can exhibit a property that 2, 10, or 10,000 cannot. Consciousness is precisely this sort of emergent property, a phenomenon that arises in part as a result of the sheer number of interconnections among neurons in the human brain, and that does not exist in any of the parts or in the interconnection of just a few. Quantum physics offers a similar lesson. We know that subatomic particles have the strange and charming ability to exist in two places at once. And if we assume that anything composed of these particles must behave likewise, we should expect all cows to be in all possible barns at the same time, which they obviously are not, because fixedness is another one of those properties that emerges from the interaction of a terribly large number of terribly tiny parts that do not themselves have it. In short, more is not just more, it is sometimes other than less. The magic of large numbers works along with the laws of probability to remedy many of the problems associated with the imperfect measurement of subjective experience. You know that if a fair coin is flipped on several occasions, it should come up heads about half the time. As such, if you have nothing better to do on a Tuesday evening, I invite you to meet me at the Grafton Street Pub in Harvard Square and play an endearingly mindless game called Splitting the Tab with Dan. Here's how it works. We flip a coin, I call heads, you call tails, and the loser pays the good barkeep, Paul, for our beers each time. Now, if we flipped the coin four times and I won on three of them, you would undoubtedly chalk it up to bad luck on your part and challenge me to darts. But if we flipped the coin 4 million times and I won on 3 million of them, then you and your associates would probably send out for a large order of tar and feathers. Why? Because even if you don't know the first thing about probability theory, you have a very keen intuition that when numbers are small, little imperfections like a stray gust of wind or a dab of perspiration on a finger can influence the outcome of a coin flip. But when numbers are large, such imperfections stop mattering. There may have been a dollop of sweat on the coin on a few of the flips, and there may have been a wayward puff of air on a few others, And these imperfections might well account for the fact that the coin came up heads once more than expected when we flipped it four times. But what are the odds that these imperfections could have caused the coin to come up heads a million more times than expected? Infinitesimal, your intuition tells you, and your intuition is spot on. The odds are as close to infinitesimal as things on Earth get without disappearing altogether. This same logic can be applied to the problem of subjective experience. Suppose we were to give a pair of volunteers a pair of experiences that were meant to induce happiness, say, by giving $1 million to one of them and the gift of a small caliber revolver to the other. We then ask each volunteer to tell us how happy he or she is. The nouveau riche volunteer says she is ecstatic, and the armed volunteer says he is mildly pleased, though perhaps not quite as pleased as one ought to make an armed volunteer. Is it possible that the two are actually having the same subjective emotional experiences but describing them differently? Yes. The new millionaire may be demonstrating politeness rather than joy, or perhaps the new pistol owner is experiencing ecstasy, but because he recently shook the hand of God near the Great Barrier Reef, is describing his ecstasy as mere satisfaction. These problems are real problems, significant problems, and we'd be foolish to conclude on the basis of these two reports that happiness is not, as it were, a warm gun. But if we gave away 1 million pistols and 1 million envelopes of money, and if 90% of the people who got new money claimed to be happier than 90% of the people who got new weapons, the odds that we're being deceived by the idiosyncrasies of verbal descriptions become very small indeed. Similarly, if a person tells us that she's happier with today's banana cream pie than with yesterday's coconut cream pie, we may rightfully worry that she's misremembering her prior experience. But if this were to happen over and over again with hundreds or thousands of people, some of whom tasted the coconut cream pie before the banana cream pie and some of whom tasted it after, we would have good reason to suspect that different pies really do give rise to different experiences, one of which is more pleasant than the other. After all, what are the odds that everyone misremembers banana cream pie as better and coconut cream pie as worse than they really were? The fundamental problem in the science of experience is that if either the language squishing hypothesis or the experience stretching hypothesis is correct, then every one of us may have a different mapping of what we experience on to what we say. And because subjective experiences can be shared only by saying, the true nature of those experiences can never be perfectly measured. In other words, if the experience and description scales are calibrated a bit differently for every person who uses them, then it's impossible for scientists to compare the claims of two people. That's a problem. But the problem isn't with the word compare. It's with the word two. Two is too small a number. And when it becomes 200 or 2,000, the different calibrations of different individuals begin to cancel one another out. If the workers at the factory that makes all the world's tape measures, rulers, and yardsticks got sloshed at a holiday party and started turning out millions of slightly different sized measuring instruments, we wouldn't feel confident that a dinosaur was larger than a turnip if you measured one and I measured the other. After all, we may have used pickled rulers. But if hundreds of people with hundreds of rulers stepped up to one of these objects and took its measurements, we could average those measurements and feel reasonably confident that a Tyrannosaurus is indeed bigger than a root vegetable. After all, what are the odds that all the people who measured the dinosaur just so happened to have stretched rulers, and that all the people who measured the turnip just so happened to have squished rulers? Yes, it is possible, and the odds can be calculated quite precisely, but I will spare you the math and promise you that they are so slender that writing them down would endanger the world's supply of zeros. The bottom line is this. The attentive person's honest, real-time report is an imperfect approximation of her subjective experience, but it's the only game in town. When a fruit salad, a lover, or a jazz trio is just too imperfect for our tastes, we stop eating, kissing, and listening. But the law of large numbers suggests that when a measurement is too imperfect for our tastes, we should not stop measuring. Quite the opposite, we should measure again and again and again until niggling imperfections yield to the onslaught of data. Those subatomic particles that like to be everywhere at once seem to cancel out one another's behavior so that the large conglomeration of particles that we call cows, cars, and French Canadians stay exactly where we put them. By the same logic, the careful collection of a large number of experiential reports allows the imperfections of one to cancel out the imperfections of another. No individual's report may be taken as an unimpeachable and perfectly calibrated index of his experience, not yours, not mine, but we can be confident that if we ask enough people the same question, the average answer will be a roughly accurate index of the average experience. The science of happiness requires that we play the odds, and thus the information it provides is always at some risk of being wrong. But if you want to bet against it, then flip that coin one more time, get out your wallet, and tell Paul to make mine a Guinness. Onward. One of the most annoying songs in the often annoying history of popular music begins with this line, "Feelings, nothing more than feelings." I wince when I hear it because it always strikes me as roughly equivalent to starting a hymn with "Jesus, nothing more than Jesus." Nothing more than feelings? What could be more important than feelings? Sure, war and peace may come to mind, but are war and peace important for any reason other than the feelings they produce? If war didn't cause pain and anguish, if peace didn't provide for delights both transcendental and carnal, would either of them matter to us at all? War, peace, art, money, marriage, birth, death, disease, religion, these are just a few of the really big topics over which oceans of blood and ink have been spilled. But they're really big topics for one reason alone. Each is a powerful source of human emotion. If they didn't make us feel uplifted, desperate, thankful, and hopeless, we'd keep all that ink and blood to ourselves. As Plato asked, "Are these things good for any other reason except that they end in pleasure and get rid of and avert pain? Are you looking to any other standard but pleasure and pain when you call them good?" Indeed, feelings don't just matter, they are what mattering means. We would expect any creature that feels pain when burned and pleasure when fed to call burning and eating bad and good, respectively, just as we'd expect an asbestos creature with no digestive tract to find such designations arbitrary. Moral philosophers have tried for centuries to find some other way to define good and bad, but none has ever convinced the rest, or me. We can't say that something is good unless we can say what it's good for. And if we examine all the many objects and experiences that our species calls good and ask what they are good for, the answer is clear. By and large, they are good for making us feel happy. Given the importance of feelings, it would be nice to be able to say precisely what they are and how one might measure them. As we've seen, we can't do that with the kind of precision that scientists covet. Nonetheless, if the methodological and conceptual tools that science has developed don't allow us to measure the feelings of a single individual with pinpoint accuracy, they at least allow us to go stumbling in the dark with pickled rulers to measure dozens of individuals again and again. The problem facing us is a difficult one, but it's too important to ignore. Why do we so often fail to know what will make us happy in the future? Science offers some intriguing answers to this question, and now that we have a sense of the problem and a general method for solving it, we're ready to inspect them. Part 3. Realism. The belief that things are in reality as they appear to be in the mind. Chapter 4. In the blind spot of the mind's eye. And as imagination bodies forth the forms of things unknown, the poet's pen turns them to shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream. This much we know for sure. Adolf Fischer did not organize the riot. He did not incite the riot. In fact, he was nowhere near the riot the night the policemen were killed. But his labor union had challenged the stranglehold that Chicago's powerful industrialists had on the men, women, and children who toiled in their sweatshops toward the end of the 19th century, and that union needed to be taught a lesson. So Adolf Fischer was tried, and on the basis of paid and perjured testimony, sentenced to die for a crime he didn't commit. On November 11th, 1887, he stood on the gallows and surprised everyone with his last words. "This is the happiest moment of my life," he said. A few seconds later, the trapdoor beneath his feet fell away, the rope snapped his neck, and he was dead. Fortunately, his dreams of equity in the American workplace weren't so easily exterminated. 1 year after Fischer was hanged, a bright young fellow perfected the process of dry photography, launched his revolutionary Kodak camera, and instantly became one of the richest men in the world. In the decades that followed, George Eastman developed a revolutionary management philosophy as well, giving his employees shorter hours, disability benefits, retirement annuities, life insurance, profit sharing, and ultimately, one-third of the stock in his company. On March 14, 1932, the beloved inventor and humanitarian sat down at his desk, wrote a brief note, neatly capped his fountain pen, and smoked a cigarette. Then he surprised everyone by killing himself. Fisher and Eastman are a fascinating contrast. Both men believed that common laborers have a right to fair wages and decent working conditions, and both dedicated much of their lives to bringing about social change at the dawn of the industrial age. Fisher failed abysmally and died a criminal, poor and reviled. Eastman succeeded absolutely and died a champion, affluent and venerated. So why did a poor man who had accomplished so little stand happily at the threshold of his own lynching, while a rich man who had accomplished so much felt driven to take his own life? Fisher's and Eastman's reactions to their respective situations seem so contrary, so completely inverted, that one is tempted to chalk them up to false bravado or mental aberration. Fisher was apparently happy on the last day of a wretched existence. Eastman was apparently unhappy on the last day of a fulfilling life, and we know full well that if we had been standing in either of their places, we would have experienced precisely the opposite emotions. So what was wrong with these guys? I'll ask you to consider the possibility that there was nothing wrong with them, but that there is something wrong with you, and with me too. And the thing that's wrong with both of us is that we make a systematic set of errors when we try to imagine what it would feel like if. Imagining what it would feel like if sounds like a fluffy bit of daydreaming, but in fact it's one of the most consequential mental acts we can perform, and we perform it every day. We make decisions about whom to marry, where to work, when to reproduce, where to retire, and we base these decisions in large measure on our beliefs about how it would feel if this event happened, but that one didn't. Our lives may not always turn out as we wish or as we plan, but we're confident that if they had, then our happiness would have been unbounded and our sorrows thin and fleeting. Perhaps it's true that we can't always get what we want, but at least we feel sure that we know what to want in the first place. We know that happiness is to be found on the golf course and not on the assembly line, with Lana but not with Lisa, as a potter but not as a plumber, in Atlanta but not in Afghanistan, and we know these things because we can look forward in time and simulate worlds that don't yet exist. Whenever we find ourselves in the front end of a decision, should I have another fish stick or go directly for the ding-dongs, accept the job in Kansas City, or stay put and hope for a promotion, have the knee surgery, or try the physical therapy first? We imagine the futures that our alternatives provide and then imagine how we would feel in each of them. And we don't have to imagine very hard to know that we would be happier as the CEO of a Fortune 500 company than as the deadweight on a hangman's rope. Because we are the ape that looked forward, we don't actually have to live Adolf Fisher's or George Eastman's lives to know how it would feel to walk a mile in their shoes. There's just one catch. The owners of the shoes didn't seem to agree with our conclusions. Fisher claimed to be happy. Eastman acted like a man who wasn't. So unless these guys were wrong about how it felt to live their own lives, we're forced to consider the possibility that the mistake is ours. That when we tried to imagine how it would feel to be in Fisher's or Eastman's situations, our imaginations failed us in some curious way. We're forced to consider the possibility that what clearly seems to be the better life may actually be the worse life, and that when we look down the timeline at the different lives we might lead, we may not always know which is which. We're forced to consider the possibility that we did something fundamentally wrong when we mentally slipped out of our shoes and into theirs, and that this fundamental mistake can cause us to choose the wrong future. What might this mistake be? Imagination is a powerful tool that allows us to conjure images from airy nothing. But like all tools, this one has its shortcomings, and in this and the next chapter, I'll tell you about the first of them. The best way to understand this particular shortcoming of imagination, which is the faculty that allows us to see the future, is to understand the shortcomings of memory, which is the faculty that allows us to see the past, and perception, which is the faculty that allows us to see the present. As you'll learn, the shortcoming that causes us to misremember the past and misperceive the present is the very same shortcoming that causes us to misimagine the future. That shortcoming is caused by a trick that your brain plays on you every minute of every hour of every day, a trick that your brain is playing on you right now. Let me tell you about the brain's dirty little secret. Little Big Head. There's a marvelous moment in most of the early Marx Brothers films in which Harpo, the cherubic mime, reaches deep into the folds of his floppy trench coat and pulls out a flugelhorn, a steaming cup of coffee, a bathroom sink, or a sheep. By the age of 3, most of us have learned that big things can't go inside little things, and that understanding is violated to comic effect when someone pulls plumbing or livestock from his pockets. How can a flugelhorn fit inside a raincoat? How can that tiny car hold all those merry clowns? How can the magician's assistant get folded up inside that little box? They can't, of course, and we know that, which is why we are so appreciative of the illusion that they do. Filling in memory. The human brain creates a similar illusion. If you've ever tried to store a full season of your favorite television show on your computer's hard drive, then you already know that faithful representations of things in the world require gobs of space. And yet, our brains take millions of snapshots, record millions of sounds, add smells, tastes, textures, a third spatial dimension, a temporal sequence, a continuous running commentary, and they do this all day, every day, year after year, storing these representations of the world in a memory bank that seems never to overflow and yet allows us to recall at a moment's notice that awful day in the 6th grade when we teased Phil Myers about his braces and he promised to beat us up after school. How do we cram the vast universe of our experience into the relatively small storage compartment between our ears? We do what Harpo did. We cheat. As you learned in the previous chapters, the elaborate tapestry of our experience isn't stored in memory, at least not in its entirety. Rather, it's compressed for storage by first being reduced to a few critical threads, such as a summary phrase, "dinner was disappointing," or a small set of key features, "tough steak," "corked wine," "snotty waiter." Later, when we want to remember our experience, our brains quickly reweave the tapestry by fabricating, not by actually retrieving, the bulk of the information that we experience as a memory. This fabrication happens so quickly and effortlessly that we have the illusion, as a good magician's audience always does, that the entire thing was in our heads the entire time. But it wasn't, and that fact can be easily demonstrated. For example, volunteers in one study were shown a series of slides depicting a red car as it cruises towards a yield sign, turns right, and then knocks over a pedestrian. After seeing the slides, some of the volunteers, those in the no question group, were not asked any questions. And other volunteers, those in the question group, were. The question these volunteers were asked was this: did another car pass the red car while it was stopped at the stop sign? Next, all the volunteers were shown 2 pictures, one in which the red car was approaching a yield sign and one in which the red car was approaching a stop sign, and they were asked to point to the picture they had actually seen. Now, if the volunteers had stored their experience in memory, then they should have pointed to the picture of the car approaching the yield sign. And indeed, more than 90% of the volunteers in the no question group did just that. But 80% of the volunteers in the question group pointed at the picture of the car approaching a stop sign. Clearly, the question changed the volunteers' memories of their earlier experience, which is precisely what one would expect if their brains were reweaving their experiences, and precisely what one would not expect if their brains were retrieving their experiences. This general finding, that information acquired after an event alters memory of the event, has been replicated so many times in so many different laboratories and field settings that it's left most scientists convinced of 2 things. First, the act of remembering involves filling in details that were not actually stored. And second, we generally can't tell when we're doing this because filling in happens quickly and unconsciously. Indeed, this phenomenon is so powerful that it happens even when we know someone's trying to trick us. For example, listen as I read to you a list of words, and then when I'm finished, I'll trick you. Here's the list: bed, rest, awake, tired, dream, wake, snooze, blanket, doze, slumber, snore, nap, peace, yawn, drowsy. Okay, here's the trick. Which of the following words wasn't on the list? Bed, doze, sleep, or gasoline? Well, the right answer is gasoline, of course, but the other right answer is sleep. If you're like most people, you knew gasoline wasn't on the list, but you mistakenly remembered reading the word sleep. Because all the words in the list are so closely related, your brain stored the gist of what you read, a bunch of words about sleeping, rather than storing every one of the words. Normally, this would be a clever and economical strategy for remembering. The gist would serve as an instruction that enabled your brain to reweave the tapestry of your experience and allow you to remember the words you heard. But in this case, your brain was tricked by the fact that the gist word, the key word, the essential word, wasn't actually on the list. When your brain rewove the tapestry of your experience, it mistakenly included a word that was implied by the gist, but that wasn't actually there, just as volunteers in the previous study mistakenly included a stop sign that was implied by the question they had been asked, but that had not actually appeared in the slides they saw. This experiment has been done dozens of times with dozens of different word lists, and these studies have revealed two surprising findings. First, people don't vaguely recall seeing the gist word, and they don't simply guess that they saw the gist word. Rather, they vividly remember seeing it, and they feel completely confident that it appeared. Second, this phenomenon happens even when people are warned about it beforehand. Knowing that a researcher is trying to trick you into falsely recalling the appearance of a gist word doesn't stop that false recollection from happening. Filling in perception. The powerful and undetectable filling in that suffuses our remembrances of things past pervades our perceptions of things present as well. For instance, if on one particularly slow Tuesday you took it upon yourself to dissect your eyeball, you'd eventually come across a spot on the back of your retina where your optic nerve leaves your eye and wends its way towards your brain. The eyeball can't register an image at the point at which the optic nerve attaches, and hence that point is known as the blind spot. No one can see an object that appears in the blind spot because there aren't visual receptors there. And yet, if you look out into your living room, you don't notice a black hole in the otherwise smooth picture of your brother-in-law sitting on the sofa devouring cheese dip. Why? Because your brain uses information from the areas around the blind spot to make a reasonable guess about what the blind spot would see if only it weren't blind. And then your brain fills in the scene with this information. That's right, it invents things, creates things, makes stuff up. It doesn't consult you about this, doesn't seek your approval, it just makes its best guess about the nature of the missing information and proceeds to fill in the scene. And the part of your visual experience of your cheese-dipping brother-in-law that's caused by real light reflecting off of his real face, and the part that your brain just made up, look exactly alike to you. The filling in trick isn't limited to the visual world. Researchers tape-recorded the sentence, "The state governors met with their respective legislatures convening in the capital city." Then they doctored the tape, substituting a cough for the first S in legislatures. Volunteers heard the cough all right, but they heard it happening between the words, because they heard the missing S too. Even when they were specifically instructed to listen for the missing sound, and even when they were given thousands of trials of practice, volunteers weren't able to name the missing letter that their brains knew ought to be there and had thus helpfully supplied. In an even more remarkable study, volunteers listened to a recording of the word eel preceded by a cough. The volunteers heard the word peel when it was embedded in the sentence "the eel was on the orange." But they heard the word heel when it was embedded in the sentence "the eel was on the shoe." This is a striking finding because the two sentences differ only in their final word, which means that volunteers' brains had to wait for the last word of the sentence before they could supply the information that was missing from the second word. But they did it, and they did it so smoothly and quickly that volunteers actually heard the missing information being spoken in its proper position. Experiments such as these provide us with a backstage pass that allows us to see how the brain does its marvelous magic act. Of course, if you went backstage at a magic show and got a good look at all the wires, mirrors, and trapdoors, the show would be spoiled when you returned to your seat. After all, once you know how a trick works, you can't fall for it, right? Well, in fact, no matter how much you learn about your blind spot, it always remains blind, and you always see what your brain fills in. How can that be? I've tried to convince you that things aren't always as they appear. Now let me try to convince you that you can't help but believe that they are. The Meatloaf of Oz. Unless you skipped over childhood and went straight from strained carrots to mortgage payments, you probably remember the scene in the book The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, in which Dorothy and her pals are cowering before the great and terrible Oz, who appears menacingly as a giant floating head. Toto, the dog, suddenly breaks loose, knocks over a screen in the corner of the room, and reveals a little man working the controls of a machine. The protagonists are astonished, and the Scarecrow accuses the little man of being a humbug. "Exactly so," declared the little man, rubbing his hands together as if it pleased him. "I am a humbug." "Doesn't anyone else know you're a humbug?" asked Dorothy. "No one knows it but you four and myself," replied Oz. "I fooled everyone so long that I thought I should never be found out."
"But I don't understand," said Dorothy in bewilderment. "How was it that you appeared to me as a great head?"
"That was one of my tricks," answered Oz.
"I think you are a very bad man," said Dorothy.
"Oh, no, my dear. I'm really a very good man, but I'm a very bad wizard."
Discovering idealism.
Toward the end of the 18th century, philosophers had approximately the same sort of eye-opening experience that Dorothy had and concluded, with some reluctance, that while the human brain is a very good organ, it's a very bad wizard. Prior to that time, philosophers had thought of the senses as conduits that allowed information about the properties of objects in the world to travel from the object and into the mind. The mind was like a movie screen in which the object was rebroadcast. The operation broke down on occasion, hence people occasionally saw things as they were not. But when the senses were working properly, they showed what was there. This theory of realism was described in 1690 by the philosopher John Locke. "When our senses do actually convey into our understandings any idea, we cannot but be satisfied that there doth something at that time really exist without us, which doth affect our senses, and by them give notice of itself to our apprehensive faculties, and actually produce that idea which we then perceive. And we cannot so far distrust their testimony as to doubt that such collections of simple ideas as we have observed by our senses to be united together do really exist together." In other words, brains believe, but they don't make believe. When people see giant floating heads, it's because giant heads are actually floating in their purview, and the only question for a psychologically minded philosopher was how brains accomplished this amazing act of faithful reflection. But in 1781, a reclusive German professor named Immanuel Kant broke loose, knocked over the screen in the corner of the room, and exposed the brain as a humbug of the highest order. Kant's new theory of idealism claimed that our perceptions aren't the result of a physiological process by which our eyes somehow transmit an image of the world into our brains, but rather they're the result of a psychological process that combines what our eyes see with what we already think, feel, know, want, and believe, and then uses this combination of sensory information and pre-existing knowledge to construct our perceptions of reality. As Kant wrote, "The understanding can intuit nothing. The senses can think nothing. Only through their union can knowledge arise." The historian Will Durant performed the remarkable feat of summarizing Kant's point in a single sentence. "The world as we know it is a construction, a finished product, almost, one might say, a manufactured article to which the mind contributes as much by its molding forms as the thing contributes by its stimuli." Kant argued that a person's perception of a floating head is constructed from the person's knowledge of floating heads, memory of floating heads, belief in floating heads, need for floating heads, and sometimes, but not always, from the actual presence of a floating head itself. Perceptions are portraits, not photographs, and their form reveals the artist's hand every bit as much as it reflects the things portrayed. This theory was a revelation. And then the centuries that followed, psychologists extended it by suggesting that each individual makes roughly the same journey of discovery that philosophy did. In the 1920s, the psychologist Jean Piaget noticed that the young child often fails to distinguish between her perception of an object and the object's actual properties. Hence, she tends to believe that things really are as they appear to be, and that others must therefore see them as she does. When a 2-year-old sees her playmate leave the room, and then sees an adult remove a cookie from a cookie jar and hide it in a drawer, she expects that her playmate will later look for the cookie in the drawer, despite the fact that her playmate was not in the room when the adult moved the cookie to the drawer from the jar. Why? Because the 2-year-old child knows the cookie is in the drawer and thus expects that everyone else knows this as well.
without a distinction between things in the world and things in the mind. The child can't understand how different minds can contain different things. Of course, with increasing maturity, children shift from realism to idealism, coming to realize that perceptions are merely points of view, that what they see isn't necessarily what there is, and that two people may thus have different perceptions of or beliefs about the same thing. Piaget concluded that the child is a realist in its thought, and that its progress consists in ridding itself of this initial realism. In other words, like philosophers, ordinary people start out as realists but get over it soon enough. Escaping realism. But if realism goes away, it doesn't get very far. Research shows that even adults act like realists under certain circumstances. For example, in one study, a pair of adult volunteers played a game. A variety of common objects were placed in front of them, things like candles, blocks, and toy cars, and the game involved having one volunteer tell the other volunteer to pick up an item and move it. What made the game interesting was this. One volunteer had what we might call the perfect view. Mr. Perfect was positioned so that he could see every one of the items perfectly well. But the other volunteer had what we might call the partial view. Mr. Partial was seated so that he could see most of the items, but not all of them. A few of the items were out of his line of sight. Now, three of the items were toy trucks, a large one, a medium one, and a small one. Mr. Perfect could see all three of the trucks, but Mr. Partial could only see the large one and the medium one. The small truck was out of Mr. Partial's sight and could only be seen by Mr. Perfect. So, what should have happened when Mr. Partial told Mr. Perfect to move the small truck? Well, if Mr. Perfect were an idealist, then he would move the medium truck, because he would realize that Mr. Partial couldn't actually see the small truck. Hence, when Mr. Partial said small truck, he must have been referring to the medium truck, which, from Mr. Partial's point of view, was the smallest. On the other hand, if Mr. Perfect were a realist, then he would move the small truck without regard for the fact that Mr. Partial could not see it as he could, hence could not have been referring to it when he gave his instruction. So, which truck did Mr. Perfect actually move? The medium truck, of course. What, did you think these volunteers were stupid? They were normal adults. They had intact brains, good jobs, bank accounts, nice table manners, all the usual stuff. They knew that Mr. Partial had a different point of view and thus must have been talking about the medium truck when he said, move the small truck. But, while these normal adults with intact brains behaved like perfect idealists, their hands told only half the story. In addition to measuring Mr. Perfect's hand movements, the researchers used an eye tracker to measure his eye movements as well. The eye tracker revealed that the moment Mr. Perfect heard the phrase, move the small truck, he briefly looked towards the small truck, not the medium truck, which was the smallest truck that Mr. Partial could see, but the small truck, which was the smallest truck that he could see. In other words, Mr. Perfect's brain initially interpreted the phrase, the small truck, as a reference to the smallest truck from his own point of view, without regard for the fact that Mr. Partial's point of view was different. Only after briefly flirting with the idea of moving the small truck did Mr. Perfect's brain consider the fact that Mr. Partial had a different view and thus must have meant the medium truck, at which point his brain sent his hand instructions to move the proper truck. The hand behaved like an idealist, but the eye revealed that the brain was a momentary realist. Experiments such as these suggest that we don't outgrow realism so much as we learn to outfox it, and that even as adults, our perceptions are characterized by an initial moment of realism. According to this line of reasoning, we automatically assume that our subjective experience of a thing is a faithful representation of the thing's properties. Only later, if we have the time, energy, and ability, do we rapidly repudiate this assumption and consider the possibility that the real world may not actually be as it appears to us. Piaget described realism as a spontaneous and immediate tendency to confuse the sign and the thing signified. And research shows that this tendency to equate our subjective sense of things with the objective properties of those things remains spontaneous and immediate throughout our lives. It doesn't go away forever, and it doesn't go away on occasion. Rather, it's brief, unarticulated, and rapidly unraveled, but it's always the first step in our perception of the world. We believe what we see, and then unbelieve it when we have to. All of this suggests that the psychologist George Miller was right when he wrote, "The crowning intellectual accomplishment of the brain is the real world." The 3.5-pound meatloaf between our ears isn't a simple recording device, but a remarkably smart computer that gathers information, makes shrewd judgments and even shrewder guesses, and offers us its best interpretation of the way things are. Because those interpretations are usually so good, because they usually bear such a striking resemblance to the world as it is actually constituted, we don't realize that we're seeing an interpretation. Instead, we feel as though we're sitting comfortably inside our heads, looking out through the clear glass windshields of our eyes, watching the world as it truly is. We tend to forget that our brains are talented forgers, weaving a tapestry of memory and perception whose detail is so compelling that its inauthenticity is rarely detected. In a sense, each of us is a counterfeiter who prints phony dollar bills and then happily accepts them for payment, unaware that he's both the perpetrator and victim of a well-orchestrated fraud. As you're about to see, we sometimes pay a steep price for allowing ourselves to lose sight of this fundamental fact, because the mistake we make when we momentarily ignore the filling-in trick and unthinkingly accept the validity of our memories and our perceptions is precisely the same mistake we make when we imagine our futures. An embarrassment of tomorrows. When John Lennon asked us to imagine there's no countries, he was quick to add, "It isn't hard to do." Indeed, imagination is usually effortless. When we think about the pastrami on rye that we intend to have for lunch or the new pair of flannel pajamas that Mom swears she mailed last week, we don't have to set aside a block of time between our other appointments, roll up our sleeves, and get down to the serious work of conjuring up images of sandwiches and sleepwear. Rather, the moment we have the slightest inclination to consider these things, our brains effortlessly use what they know about delis and lunches and parcels and moms to construct mental pictures that we experience as the products of imagination. Like perceptions and memories, these mental pictures pop into our consciousness fait accompli. We should be grateful for the ease with which our imaginations provide this useful service, but because we don't consciously supervise the construction of these mental images, we tend to treat them as we treat memories and perceptions, initially assuming that they are accurate representations of the objects we're imagining. For instance, right now you can probably imagine a plate of spaghetti and tell me how much you would enjoy eating it for dinner tomorrow evening. Fine. Now, notice two things. First, this wasn't particularly taxing. You could probably imagine pasta all day long without ever breaking a sweat, letting your brain do the heavy construction work while you lounge around in your new pajamas. Second, notice that the spaghetti you imagined was much richer than the spaghetti I asked you about. Perhaps your imaginary spaghetti was the goopy slop from the can, or perhaps it was a fresh basil rosemary pasta topped with a silky bolognese. The sauce could have been tomato, cream, clam, or even grape jelly. The noodles might have been piled beneath a pair of traditional meatballs or sprinkled with a half dozen slivers of duck sausage studded with capers and pine nuts. Maybe you imagined eating the spaghetti while standing at your kitchen counter with a newspaper in one hand and a Coke in the other, or maybe you imagined that your waiter had given you the small table near the fireplace at your favorite trattoria and poured you a fat 1990 Barolo to start. Whatever you imagined, it's a pretty good bet that when I said spaghetti, you didn't have an unrequited urge to interrogate me about the nuances of sauce and locale before envisioning a single noodle. Instead, your brain behaved like a portrait artist commissioned to produce a full-color oil from a rough charcoal sketch, filling in all the details that were absent from my question and serving you a particular heaping helping of imaginary pasta. And when you estimated your enjoyment of this future spaghetti, you responded to this particular mental image as you respond to particular memories and particular perceptions, as though the details had been specified by the thing you were imagining rather than fabricated by your brain. In so doing, you made an error that your future spaghetti-eating self may regret. The phrase "spaghetti for dinner tomorrow evening" doesn't describe an event so much as it describes a family of events, and the particular member of the family that you imagined influenced your predictions about how much you'd enjoy eating it. Indeed, trying to predict how much you'll enjoy a plate of spaghetti without knowing which plate of spaghetti is like trying to predict how much you'll pay for a car without knowing which car, Ferrari or Chevy, or trying to predict how proud you'll be of your spouse's accomplishment without knowing which accomplishment, winning a Nobel Prize or finding the best divorce lawyer in the city. Or trying to predict how sad you'll be when a relative dies without knowing which relative, dear old dad or cranky great Uncle Sherman on Cousin Ida's side twice removed. There are endless variations on spaghetti, and the particular variation you imagined surely influenced how much you expected to enjoy the experience. Because these details are so crucial to an accurate prediction of your response to the event you were imagining, and because these important details weren't known, you would have been wise to withhold your prediction about spaghetti, or at least to temper it with a disclaimer such as, "I expect to like the spaghetti if it is al dente with smoked pomodoro." But I'm willing to bet that you didn't withhold, you didn't disclaim, and that you instead conjured up a plate of imaginary spaghetti faster than Chef Boyardee on rollerblades, then made a confident prediction about the relationship you expected to have with that food. If you didn't do that, then congratulations, give yourself a medal. But if you did, then know you're not alone. Research suggests that when people make predictions about their reactions to future events, they tend to neglect the fact that their brains have performed the filling-in trick as an integral part of the act of imagination. For example, volunteers in one study were asked to predict what they would do in a variety of future situations. How much time they would be willing to spend answering questions in a telephone survey, how much money they'd be willing to spend to celebrate a special occasion at a restaurant in San Francisco, and so on. Volunteers also reported how confident they were that each of these predictions was correct. Before making the predictions, some volunteers were asked to describe all the details of the future event they were imagining. "I'm imagining eating wine-braised short ribs with roasted root vegetables and parsley coulis at Jardiniere." And were then told that they should assume that each of these details was perfectly accurate. Other volunteers were not asked to describe these details and were not told to make any assumptions. The results showed that volunteers who were not supposed to make assumptions were every bit as confident as those who did. Why? Because when they were asked about dinner, the non-assumers quickly and unconsciously generated a mental image of a particular dish at a particular restaurant, and then assumed that these details were accurate, rather than having been conjured from airy nothing. We all find ourselves in the same fix from time to time. Our spouse asks us to attend a party next Friday night, or brains instantly manufacture an image of a cocktail party in the penthouse of a downtown hotel with waiters in black tie carrying silver trays of hors d'oeuvres past a slightly bored harpist, and we predict our reaction to the imagined event with a yawn that sets new records for duration and jaw extension. What we generally fail to consider is how many different kinds of parties there are. Birthday celebrations, gallery openings, cast parties, yacht parties, office parties, orgies, wakes, and how different our reactions would be to each. So we tell our spouse that we'd rather skip the party. Our spouse naturally drags us along anyhow, and we have a truly marvelous time. Why? Because the party involved cheap beer and hula hoops rather than classical music and seaweed crackers. It was precisely our style, and we liked what we predicted we'd hate because our prediction was based on a detailed image that reflected our brain's best guess, which was in this case, dead wrong. The point here is that when we imagine the future, we often do so in the blind spot of our mind's eye, and this tendency can cause us to misimagine the future events whose emotional consequences we're attempting to weigh. This tendency transcends mundane predictions about parties, restaurants, and plates of spaghetti. For example, most of us have no doubt that we would enjoy being an Eastman more than we would enjoy being a Fisher. No doubt, that is, unless we pause to consider how quickly and unquestioningly our brains filled in the details of their lives and deaths, and how much all those made-up details mattered. Consider a pair of stories that your brain almost certainly didn't invent for you at the beginning of this chapter. You're a young German immigrant who lives in the teeming, dirty city that is 19th century Chicago. A few wealthy families, the Armors, McCormicks, Swifts, and Fields, have monopolized their industries and have the right to use you and your family as they would use machines and horses. You devote your time to a small newspaper whose editorials call for social justice, but you're no fool, and you know these essays will change nothing and that the factories will churn on, producing paper, producing pork, producing tractors, and spitting out the tired workers whose blood and sweat feed the engines of production. You are dispensable and insignificant. Welcome to America. One evening an altercation breaks out between some factory workers and the local police in Haymarket Square, and although you weren't present when the bomb was thrown, you're rounded up with other anarchist leaders and charged with masterminding a riot. Suddenly your name is on the front page of every major newspaper and you have a national platform for your opinions. When the judge sentences you on the basis of fabricated evidence, you realize that this ignominious moment will be preserved in history books, that you'll be known as the Haymarket Martyr, and that your execution will pave the way for the reforms you sought but were impotent to establish. A few decades from now, there will be a far better America than this one, and its citizens will honor you for your sacrifice. You are not a religious man, but you can't help but think for a moment of Jesus on the cross, falsely accused, unjustly convicted, and cruelly executed, giving his life so that a great idea might live in the centuries to come. As you prepare to die, you feel nervous, of course, but in some deep sense, this moment is a stroke of luck, the culmination of a dream, perhaps, you might even say, the happiest moment of your life. Cut to a second story. Rochester, New York, 1932, the midst of the Great Depression. You're a 77-year-old man who has spent his life building empires, advancing technology, and using your wealth to endow libraries, symphonies, colleges, and dental clinics that have improved the lives of millions. The happiest moments of your long life were spent tinkering with a camera, touring Europe's art museums, fishing, hunting, or doing carpentry in your lodge in North Carolina. But spinal disease has made it increasingly difficult for you to lead the active life you've always enjoyed. And every day you spend in bed is a sad mockery of the vibrant man you once were. You'll never get younger, and you'll never get better. The good days are over, and more days merely mean more decrepitude. One Monday afternoon, you sit down at your desk, uncap your favorite fountain pen, and write these words on a legal pad. Dear friends, my work is done. Why wait? Then you light a cigarette, and when you've enjoyed the last of it, stub it out and carefully place the nose of your Luger automatic against your chest. Your physician showed you how to locate your heart, and now you can feel it beating rapidly beneath your hand. As you prepare to pull the trigger, you feel nervous, of course, but in some deep sense you know that this one well-aimed bullet will allow you to leave a beautiful past and escape a bitter future. Okay, lights up. These details about Adolf Fischer's and George Eastman's lives are accurate, but that's not really the point. The point is that just as there are parties and pastas you like and parties and pastas you don't, there are ways of being rich and ways of being executed that make the former less marvelous and the latter less awful than we might otherwise expect. One reason why you found Fisher's and Eastman's reactions so perverse is that you almost certainly misimagined the details of their situations. And yet, without a second thought, you behaved like an unrepentant realist and confidently based your predictions about how you would feel on details that your brain had invented while you weren't watching. Your mistake wasn't in imagining things you couldn't know. That is, after all, what imagination is for. Rather, your mistake was in unthinkingly treating what you imagined as though it were an accurate representation of the facts. You're a very fine person, I'm sure, but you are a very bad wizard. Onward. If you'd been given your choice of brains at the moment of conception, you probably wouldn't have chosen the tricky one. Good thing no one asked you. Without the filling-in trick, you'd have sketchy memories, an empty imagination, and a small black hole following you wherever you went. When Kant wrote that perception without conception is blind, he was suggesting that without the filling-in trick, we'd have nothing even remotely resembling the subjective experience that all of us take for granted. We see things that aren't really there. We remember things that didn't really happen. And while these may sound like symptoms of mercury poisoning, they're actually critical ingredients in the recipe for a seamlessly smooth and blessedly normal reality. But that smoothness and normality comes at a price. Even though we are aware in some vaguely academic sense that our brains are doing the filling-in trick, we can't help but expect the future to unfold with the details we imagine. As we're about to see, the details that the brain puts in are not nearly as troubling as the details it leaves out. Chapter 5. The Hound of Silence. O hateful error, melancholy's child! Why dost thou show to the apt thoughts of men the things that are not? Shakespeare, Julius Caesar. Silver Blaze hadn't been missing for long when Inspector Gregory and Colonel Ross identified the stranger who had sneaked into the stable and stolen the prize racehorse. But as usual, Sherlock Holmes was one step ahead of the police. The colonel turned to the great detective and said, "Is there any point to which you would wish to draw my attention?" To the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime, replied Holmes.
The dog did nothing in the nighttime, said the colonel.
That, said Sherlock Holmes, was the curious incident.
It seems that a dog lived in the stable, that both of the stable hands had slept through the theft, and that these two facts had allowed Holmes to make one of his indubitably shrewd deductions. As he later explained, I had grasped the significance of the silence of the dog. A dog was kept in the stables, and yet, though someone had been in and had fetched out a horse, he had not barked enough to